Good afternoon. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. The time is about 1:32 p.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Schauer, Senator Hoffman, Senator Machicki. We also have Senator Shelley Hughes and Mia Costello, Senator Costello, joining us today. We have a quorum to do business. On today's agenda, we're looking at crime. It's all about crime. We have three bills in front of us. Senate Bill 32, Crime, Sentencing, Mental Illness, and Evidence. Senate Bill 33, Arrest, Release, Sentencing, Probation. And Senate Bill 34, Probation, Parole, Sentencing, and Credits. And we're just going to be going through these three bills over the next couple days just to have hearings on them, learn about the fiscal notes, and then eventually having public testimony. So the very first one we're going to do today is Senate Bill 32. It is an act relating to criminal law and procedure, relating to electronic monitoring, relating to controlled substances, probation, driver's license, driving while license canceled, arrests, sentencing for driving under the influence or refusal, relating to reports of involuntary commitment, and Alaska rules of criminal procedure and providing for an effective date. So Senate Finance heard this bill on April 24th and April 25th. We heard from Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections, and courts. Today, we will complete our departmental overview with the Public Defender's Office and the Office of Public Advocacy. And I think those folks will be on the phone. So first, we will hear from Beth Goldstein, Interim Public Defender. Ms. Goldstein, please identify yourself for the record, give us any opening remarks, and review any impacts on the Public Defender's Office.
Thank you, through the chair. My name is Beth Goldstein. I'm the acting public defender for the Alaska Public Defender Agency. As with law, with this bill, Senate Bill 32, we anticipate an increase in new felony drug cases, with the anticipation that there will be approximately 740 new cases based on the rollback and the statistics that law was able to give. We assume that approximately 19% of those cases will not come to the Public Defender Agency because either the defendants will not be eligible for appointed counsel or they will have a conflict with the agency, and therefore they would go to OPA or contract counsel. That leaves us with approximately 600 new felony drug cases that the agency will be handling under this legislation. We have used the American Bar Association recommended amount of 150 felony cases per attorney per year to determine what we will need with respect to these felony drug cases. And that gives us four attorneys to handle the increased caseload. We also believe that one additional attorney is going to be needed to handle the recriminalizing of the driving without a license cases, given the statistics cited by the Department of Law as far as the percentage of these misdemeanor cases that are encompassed by the entire misdemeanor docket. Finally, we're also seeking five additional support staff positions. I understand that there's been some concern that the PDA is seeking a one-to-one ratio of support staff to attorneys. That is not the case. Currently, the Public Defender Office is understaffed with respect to support staff positions, such as law office assistants and paralegals. So in order to adequately deal with the additional caseloads and not to need to request more attorney positions, four new staff will be needed for the new drug felony cases, and one additional staff will be needed for the driving cases.
So thank you, Ms. Goldstein. So this was sort of a review, it looks like, of the fiscal note. So just to kind of jump ahead, what we're looking at is it looks like around, I think it's fiscal note 8 or OMB component number 1631. So Ms. Goldstein kind of jumped right into the fiscal note, and it was a very good overview. So it looks to be about $1,040,000 a year for the to handle the new caseloads of about 600 new cases. Do we have any questions from the committee at this time Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Goldstein, are you sure this is enough money? Because I don't want you coming in here light to this finance table with a fiscal note.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, actually the fiscal note that was cited is not the correct fiscal note. The updated fiscal note based on law going back and asking for an additional position is actually $1,300,000.
Okay, so follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up, Senator Bishop.
So can you tell me how your world works in and of the fact that 750 new cases a year, you described a percentage that would not come before you. Do you think those will all go to trial in 1 year? And if we got 600 more cases next year, I'm just looking at how things could get stacked up there. And are we going to be able to execute and do what we want to do with these staffing levels that you have right here?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Bishop. It is not anticipated that all of these cases will go to trial. Many of them will resolve. But the way the American Bar Association looks at this is drug cases, for the most part, are basic felony cases. While some are more complicated than others, in their studies and review, they have determined that a reasonable caseload for a felony-level attorney to handle is 150 cases per year. That we also have determined that that's a reasonable felony caseload. Because these cases will move through the system, while a percentage of them will go to trial, based on our experience with moving cases from initial arraignment through to sentencing, we would be able to handle 600 more cases with 4 felony level attorneys.
Okay, thank you. I'll talk to the co-chairs after on this. Thank you.
Okay, so as a correction, OMB component number 1631 should be reflected of $1,300,000 as the correct fiscal note. Are there any other questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On section 47, there is a switch, and it will allow hearsay evidence received through Aspen to be presented to a grand jury. Do you have any concerns with that, or do you support that section?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, we do have some concerns about that from the perspective of what the state needs to prove at grand jury. That is just a grand jury difference. While we don't participate in grand jury proceedings typically, what we will be seeing is that it may take a little longer to plead those cases out because we will not have the certified judgments from grand jury on. So with respect to having to litigate whether or not those prior convictions were actual convictions and absent is accurate may cause us additional work on a caseload.
Senator Wilikowski, follow-up.
Does that result in an increased fiscal note for you, do you believe, or just increased workload?
I believe, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe it'll just increase the workload slightly, and there's no way to determine what that would mean from a fiscal note perspective.
Okay. Good, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
Different topic. Section 29 deals with changing the time to be served for possession. Well, it deals with manufacturing and trafficking of drugs, but the one I'm interested in is the possession aspect of it. And so as I understand it, generally, first two offenses for simple possession are currently, I believe, a Class A misdemeanor with no jail time. And this changes it to, I believe, a Class C felony with 0 to 2 presumed, up to 5 years in jail. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's my understanding.
And
Senator Wilikowski.
Just from a policy perspective, do you have any thoughts on that as a new state policy, making first-time possessors of drugs felons?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, certainly with respect to increasing the potential jail time sentence that any first-time felon, first-time drug possessor could be subject to will increase litigation. It will increase caseloads. But this is a policy decision for the legislature.
Senator Wilikowski.
That's probably wise on your part. But I'm just curious how many cases of the 600 new felony drug cases you expect to get. Do you have any sense of how many of those would be first-time possessors of drugs? And that's question one. And then question two would be the what we hear from the prosecutors is that we need to have this felony provision because that's the only way that we're going to drive some of these people to get treatment and take care of themselves. And I'm curious if you have an opinion on whether you agree with that or not.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, with respect to your first question, how many of these cases, these 600 cases, might be first-time drug possession? There's no way for us to tell that, at least at this point. We've put in a brand new database system that went into place last August, which may allow us to track things more thoroughly going forward, meaning by statute number versus by case type. But currently, I wouldn't be able to tell you by looking back at our data how many new cases of the 600 may be encompassed in this new legislation. With respect to the second question, from a philosophy perspective on drug usage and my experience in public defense work, locking people up does not cause them to go to treatment unless there's treatment available for them. What it does, the more time someone spends in jail, of course, they are not able to commit crimes, but it only prevents their ability to use drugs during that time in jail. It's not necessarily an incentive to change behavior.
So, Senator Wilikowski, I'd like just to see if there's other folks who have questions so we can come back to you. Okay, Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like when I'm looking at the sectional analysis, it's probably correct. In state affairs, we stripped out the DNA testing section because there was a lot of personal privacy concerns, I believe, but I want to clarify as I'm looking through them that they are not up to date on the fiscal notes because it still shows all of those that the DNA section is in there. So I just want to make sure we're not missing something here because that was a significant section that was a change. So does anyone have data? Because I see, like I said, as I'm looking through, it looks like most of them still have that. Can somebody comment to that? If anybody knows the answer.
So I guess the question is Ms. Goldstein, are you working with the OMB administrative director for your area to get us new fiscal notes?
Through the chair, yes. My understanding is that is a typo in the fiscal note that was submitted to you. We recognized it yesterday, and we are working with OMB to correct that.
And, Madam Chair, it looks like a couple other ones may have that, so it would be a recurring comment just to make sure it's correct.
Thank you, Senator Schauer, for bringing that up. Are there any further questions? Okay, Senator Wilikowski, do you have any questions?
I think my biggest concern with this bill, Madam Chair, is the changing of simple drug possession to a felony for the first offense. And I've got an amendment that my office has been working on and communicated that with your office. And I guess I'm just curious, from your perspective, what are the long-term impacts of someone getting a felony arrested? Can you talk a little bit about how that impacts their ability, if it does, to get future jobs or future maybe educational opportunities, housing opportunities, if you're aware?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, having a felony conviction has a whole host of problems associated with it, from not being able to vote to not being able to obtain a job due to the fact that many of you might be aware applications always ask whether or not you've been convicted of a felony. It can have ramifications with respect to child custody issues. It can have ramifications with respect to housing issues if public housing is needed. Having a felony on your record can really put you behind the eight ball in many, many respects in life, and it can be very difficult to dig out of that.
Senator Wilikowski.
And one of the arguments that we've heard from the district attorney, the prosecutors, is that, well, someone's caught with simple possession, we could just plead it down to a misdemeanor. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that as a rationale and what your experience is with seeing those cases pled. I'm talking simple possession.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, of course, when you are initially charged with a felony, you have potentially higher bail requirements. Being charged with the felony off the bat can cause you to lose your job. It can cause you to lose your housing. It can potentially cause you to temporarily lose your children because it's a felony versus the misdemeanor. So while ultimately being charged with a misdemeanor and pleading to a misdemeanor or being convicted of a misdemeanor and being charged with a felony that pleads down to a misdemeanor may ultimately have the same sentencing outcome, there are different ramifications in life.
Senator Wilikowski.
I think this is my last one, Madam Chair. One of the other things, the other arguments that we've heard from the prosecutors is that these cases can be dealt with on a suspended entry of judgment and or maybe an SIS, SEJ. I'm just curious what percentage of cases, drug possession cases, are dealt with in that way, and is that a reasonable way to deal with these cases in the future?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I do not have the percentage of cases off the top of my head. I can see if we can get those numbers for you to see if we're able to determine how many felony cases end up with an SIS or an SEJ. The SIS or SEJ can be a useful tool in helping people gain treatment. It especially can work well if you're using it in some like a holistic defense setting, like a program that we have in Bethel, where there are other components involved to help the person succeed. So there are social workers that help them get medical benefits. There are housing assistance folks that help them get housing, as well as treatment assistance. So if you're looking at it from more of the holistic standpoint, it can be a useful tool to really help people get on the right track. But standing alone without the ability to get treatment and having a lot of things stacked against them, it's hard to say. It's certainly people would rather have an SIS and the ability to be able to succeed versus just a straight-up conviction.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Just a couple questions on some of your questions. What would be someone's incentive to seek treatment if they didn't have a suspended entry of judgment over their head? So what you said was it works in some places where you have these options. So if you're just going to issue a violation and turn them loose, I think they have a bit less incentive to seek treatment or rehabilitation. Would you disagree with that?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. The reality with drug addiction is that the person has to want to have the treatment. Incentives are great, but the person has to want it. And in addition to that, the addictive cycle means that people regularly try to get sober. They try for recovery, but built into that recovery is a failure rate before they can get back into recovery.
Senator Machicki, follow up.
I understand that. We have a state that is at war with residents and victims because of the drug-related crime, and I would encourage the increased use of SEJs as an option, but the walking with the violation is not working, and we see increases in property crimes that are related to supporting their habit. You earlier said that they could potentially temporarily lose custody of their children. Frankly, I don't know that someone who has a heroin addiction should have custody of their children. There are a lot of other issues that are associated with that. This change, in my view, is a lifesaver. Without adequate consequences, I think it's far less likely that they find the help they need. So my heart goes out to those that fall to addiction, but I think the carrot and a stick approach is far more successful than just the carrot. It's not working. Would you disagree with that?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, with respect to my prior answer, I believe that we were talking about the charge of the felony versus the conviction of the felony. And so it hasn't been proven necessarily at that point that the individual has any type of addiction or has even possessed. I do believe that there are a lot of obstacles to overcome when someone is addicted, and that many times when we have someone in the system for possession, and not everyone who possesses is in fact addicted, but then they lose their job or their housing, many times that creates the snowball of crime that occurs going downhill.
So I appreciate the line of questioning, but maybe we should have someone from mental health who's more in tune with addiction in particular about ramifications of a person's life via addiction versus a public defender attorney at this point. I mean, if this is not the last time we'll see this bill, and if it if you're interested, we can go down this area in terms of more of the practical aspects of addiction. I saw Senator Wilikowski's hand, and then I see Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would agree with you, Madam Chair, that we may have to hear from someone else besides the public defender's office, but my concern is availability of treatment centers. If people are wanting to seek treatment, I doubt that there are adequate facilities, even in Anchorage and Fairbanks, let alone in Bethel, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Unalaska, and Nome. So, the intent of the provision may be well and good, but the implementation, if the resources aren't there, defeats the purpose. So, if we are actually going to go down this path, we need to assure ourselves that those doors can be opened by the individuals so that they can seek treatment. But if they aren't there, why are we making this provision when it gives them false hope and doomed for failure? So I would like to pursue this issue from what's available from the medical field of the state of Alaska, particularly those in rural areas of the state.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. You bring up a good point. It's a whole system to address addiction. Senator Wilson.
Yeah, so on that line, to respond to the senator from Bethel, you know, we've had four major substance abuse agencies close because without this or else the stick to go along with the carrot, folks don't have an incentive to go to treatment. They'd rather just do a flat time. Hey, I can spend a week in jail, or I can do 6 to 9 months of inpatient treatment. I mean, we've lost several residential facilities and outpatient facilities in the state and Bethel. I mean, I know one in Fairbanks, Kenai, two in Anchorage, and three in the Mat-Su. They all close, and it's a myriad of issues. But without sort of a support of that infrastructure, you're right. I mean, we want to make sure that these, but without having that patient incentive to go, it's really hard and difficult to address this matter without sort of this additional stick to help address folks to sort of give them a better incentive than a harder jail time. They need that sort of lingering time so that can still be served on the books during their probation.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and I'll just ask you, in your experience as a public defender, what have you seen? Does it work? does the, because we've tried this, the stick method in the past where we punish people for simple possession very harshly. Does that work in getting them to stop using drugs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, sometimes that works. The reality in these situations is it isn't just treatment and it isn't just jail. It really needs to be a holistic approach. For example, when we release somebody on probation and we tell them, you need to go to 7 NA meetings a week, you need to get employment, you need to have housing, you need to have your driver's license, we're asking them to do all those things at one time. It's incredibly overwhelming. And so while they may be able to succeed in pieces, what we really need to do is approach it from a more holistic perspective and help them with all those pieces so that they can succeed in treatment. When your sobriety is very important to you, but you don't have a place to live, it's very hard to maintain, and what you want to do is go back to that addiction because it relieves that pain.
So, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, ma'am. I don't want to get, I'm liking the conversation, but I know that's, I'd like to see someday if we could have a conversation about this topic we're talking about right now, because, but I don't want to take away from the chairs what we're trying to do with this bill here today, because it's very important. It's very important. And we need to have that dialogue and what we can do to help fix that going forward. But today, I know we've got this bill in front of us. But she's exactly right.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. It is a holistic approach. We did have earlier this year at the table the three different agencies to talk about opioid addiction and how they're interrelating. We had a Department of Public Safety, Health and Social Services, and Corrections. So it is hopefully under this new administration there's going to be a greater effort to address this. We are receiving federal funds in multiple fronts in terms of Homeland Security as well as specific behavioral health. I think we got $6 million from the federal government for behavioral health therapy. We're looking at a Medicaid waiver for behavioral health therapy as well. All because of the opioid addiction, among other things, that the United States is experiencing as a whole, as well as Alaska. So I do appreciate the conversation. It's very, very important. I'd like to move on to the next invited testimony. Thank you, Ms. Beth Goldstein, very much for being here today. We have now Mr. James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. So please identify yourself for the record, give us any opening remarks, and review any impacts on the Public Defender's Office from your perspective. Thank you.
Through the chair and for the record, this is James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. My OMB component number is 43. Most of the preliminary comments would be very similar to Ms. Goldstein's. Long story short, we're requesting $694,700. That equates to three attorneys and two support staff. That's what we believe we would need to absorb the increase in caseload from this particular piece of legislation.
So, committee members, you see OMB component number 43, approximately $350,000. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is incorrect.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That was an older fiscal note.
I'm sorry, yes. Okay, it's older. What's the new number again? I think I missed that.
694.
Okay. Okay, so Senator Bishop, I think I saw your hand up.
Yes, ma'am. Same question, sir. Is this fiscal note accurate? Because I don't want any late fiscal notes coming to this table.
Through the chair, I believe it is. It is based on the numbers that are most easy to monetize. Granted, there are probably additional costs, which we can't be certain of. Certainly inherent in the crime package as a whole, there is as well. But in terms of the anticipated increase in both misdemeanor and felony cases, taking into account sort of OPA's unique structure where we're broken up into essentially independent law firms, to put it simply, I think this would be enough positions for me to distribute out to the key areas and offices that will need to absorb those cases. So I think between the three attorneys and the two support staff, we should be able to absorb those anticipated case increases.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up, and I'm sure you're reading off a new fiscal note because ours still has the DNA testing in it that Senator Schauer alluded to. And does your new fiscal note have that paragraph eliminated?
Through the chair, I believe that's correct. That's still in this fiscal note. Now, there was no anticipated cost increase as a result of the DNA testing, so it shouldn't impact the fiscal note either way.
Senator Michicki has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Stinson. Can you talk a little bit about what we did in the budget this year after talking about some of these issues on the contract-to-staff funding shift? And that you're working toward resolving some of the conflict problems between the Public Defender's Agency and your agency?
Through the chair, during a subcommittee hearing, I gave a presentation. Senator Michicki was there for that. The Office of Public Advocacy has a variety of independent offices in six different cities in Alaska. However, we also rely heavily on independent contractors to take a large amount of cases. That tends to be very expensive. So in that subcommittee, what I proposed and what was ultimately put forward was to remove $500,000 out of the contractor line and then get additional PCNs for attorneys. That request did not take into account Senate Bill 32, so that's why we're asking for additional resources there. But what OPA is trying to do is find efficiencies and trying to give the taxpayer essentially the best value for their dollar. And contractors are more expensive than in-house attorneys in almost all circumstances. So we're trying to move to find out what that balance is, while at the same time being conscious of the fact that if you hire too many people, then there's more overhead because you need more lease space, et cetera. So we are working to try to find that balance, and we've also been working closely with the Public Defender's Office to ensure that conflict rates are what they're supposed to be, that there's not cases that are being inappropriately conflicted out of, and Ms. Goldstein has certainly been a partner in trying to find that balance.
Senator Wilson?
Do you find that is there different jurisdictions where you would have sort of cases that are highly more conflicted out?
Through the chair, there have been localities where there are higher conflict rates. It tends to shift around, but Kenai might be an example, particularly in the context of Senate Bill 32. You know, a smaller community like that, if there's going to be increased felony drug prosecutions, you would expect that there's going to be more co-defendants, that there's going to be more people picking up new drug cases that might have been represented by the public defenders in the past. And so in an area like that, we might have a higher conflict rate. It might be a higher conflict rate than, say, Anchorage. And so I'm not 100% sure where I'll have to place these positions, but just looking at the raw numbers, these are the positions I know that will require.
Did you follow up?
No, similar to Senator Bishop, it would be just good to sort of see sort of the rates of those conflicted cases out. Because I know in Palmer, I prefer to conflict out if I was a public defender for the person who has that contract. It just seems like a better attorney's office than the public defender's office. I just didn't know if other I've known of defendants that would do that, trying to find a way to conflict out so they can get another different attorney because they may feel that a contracted attorney might be better than the OPA or the public defender's office.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just curious if you had an expired, say, oxycodone prescription or somebody gave you one pill of their oxycodone drugs that they had because your back hurt, would that be a crime under this bill, and what would be the penalty?
Through the Through the chair, I'm not certain. I would have to go back, look at the bill itself at the amounts, but presuming that it meets the new definition of mix four, then, I mean, that would be the 0 to 2 year presumptive range, up to five.
A felony?
Correct. If it's a felony, which I believe it would be, again, assuming that meets whatever weight requirements are inherent in this version, I would have to go back and look at that.
Senator Wilikowski.
What's considered a class 6A substance, controlled substance? Is that marijuana?
Through the chair, if you could direct me to the...
Looking at page 19.
Okay.
Lines 22 through 24. It's...
Senator Wilikowski,
yes.
Do you think that maybe asking potentially Mr. Skidmore or someone who's more specific pertain to that bill, I can ask another person to come up so you can get the answer that you're looking for?
If this witness doesn't know, then yes, Madam Chair, we could do that.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski, since Mr. Skidmore is here and he can listen to your question, why don't you, I apologize for interrupting you, please finish your question, see if this gentleman, Mr. James Stinson, feels comfortable asking it or answering it. And Mr. Stinson, we do have another person here for a lifeline if you wish. So thank you, Senator Wilikowski, and I apologize. Please go back to the page you're looking at.
Do you know the answer to that question, or do you want me to ask Mr. Skidmore?
Through the chair, I think I'm more familiar with the 1A, 2A, 3A substances. I don't want to give erroneous information, and so if you would prefer to defer the question to someone else, that would be fine.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Skidmore, are you ready to go in the hot seat? Thank you. And I think what comes to mind is when we had the presentation on the fentanyl and we had the picture of the tiny, tiny, tiny grams of fentanyl, any weight of fentanyl seems to be almost deadly. Yet, to Senator Wilikowski's point, a small OxyContin of similar weight has less of an impact on the body, for example, than fentanyl. Are they treated the same under this bill?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of Senate Finance. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Through the Chair to Senator Wilikowski, your question was was a Schedule 6 controlled substance, 6A, I believe. That's
yes.
Marijuana, I believe, is what you're looking for there. The answer to your question, Madam Chair, is would OxyContin be treated the same as fentanyl? They are both considered Schedule 1A substances. The bill in front of you, SB 32, does not differentiate based on weight. However, there are other factors within the law, both aggravators and mitigators, that apply. And those, the amounts and the seriousness of that amount, or the type of damage that it can do, is treated differently. That's why there's a range in sentencing for courts to be able to factor those things in. And I would refer folks back to the Knight case. It's in the bill review letter for SB 91 that talks about those different types of factors that need to be taken into consideration in the way that Alaska's law is set up to deal with them.
Thank you. Just on Senator Wilikowski's point, I suspect that there's two issues. It's sentencing, but also just having a felony on your record. I think that while on one hand an attorney or a judge may say, well, an OxyContin is different, one OxyContin pill is different than a fentanyl, the fact that a person giving one OxyContin pill may have a felony, same as a person carrying fentanyl, is concerning. I don't know if there's a way to sever those two severe drugs and treat one differently than the other. So I'm going to ask Senator Wilikowski if he has one or two more questions, and
yes.
I see if Senator Marchicki's got his hands up.
Yeah, just on what was... Well, I guess number one, is that correct that if I had an expired prescription, or if anyone had an expired prescription for oxycodone, that would, or somebody had a bad back and somebody else gave them one of their oxycodone drugs, that would be a felony under this law, correct?
through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, the concept of giving another person a controlled substance when there isn't a prescription for it, you're correct, does qualify as a felony. However, I would also note that in my 20 years of prosecution, I've never seen a case with those facts referred to us, and every prosecutor that I've ever spoken to has always said when that hypothetical was presented that if it was presented to us, that's a case that we would be declining. There are defenses of necessity. I don't know if they would apply in the limited facts scenario that you provide us, but I understand the concern that you express. To the question that Madam Chair posed about whether or not you can treat them differently, those two schedules of fentanyl and oxycodone are both classified as a Schedule 1. That's not actually something that we control. That's something that is managed by the Controlled Substance Advisory Board that looks at the dangerousness of those types of drugs. Is it possible for you to call them out differently in statute? I think it's certainly possible, but that's not a determination that a prosecutor makes of where they land.
So, Senator Wilikowski.
On that point, can we then have a statement from the Department of Law on the record that they will not be prosecuting people for single possession of one oxycodone or similar type of drug, or because of an expired prescription, or because somebody gave them a drug? Would you be willing to make that statement on the record for the Alaskan public right now?
So through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I'm not in a position to grant immunity to a large portion of the Alaska public. That would actually be against the law for me to do that. The Attorney General has to make those sorts of decisions. But to your question of would we be declining such cases, we always do it on a case-by-case basis and analysis. In the limited fact pattern that you provided, I indicated that every prosecutor I've ever spoken to says that's not a case that they would end up accepting. So those are two different concepts, but I hope that that answer helps clarify it.
And then just one more question, Madam Chair.
One more question. Senator.
On the 4 ounces or more of a Schedule 6A controlled substance is now a felony, that's marijuana under this bill?
4 ounces or more of a controlled substance. So I'd have to look at the exact page that you're referring to, but there's a couple things that I would want to point out about marijuana through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. The quantity that you're looking at is... So I'm sorry, you've handed me a copy of your bill. We're looking at section 29, which is on page 18 and 19.
Yes,
and specifically what you're asking me about is that quantity. So possession of that amount that would be outside of what is legal in the state to do under the marijuana industry, the answer is yes. But you need to remember that the exceptions that are found on page 18, line 19, under 03.05 or 17.30 or 17.38, those are all exemptions, and that's where a lot of the marijuana exemptions exist. So it's a little more complicated than just the one subsection that talks about the amount.
Senator Marchicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that hypothetical, I think it's kind of important. Is it the intent of the administration to pass this bill so that we could go after that person who provides a single oxycodone to an individual that may be 60 or 70 miles from the harbor with a broken femur for some temporary relief?
Through the chair to Senator Marchicki, the further facts that you describe in that hypothetical really place that into more likely of a defense of necessity, and the answer to your question is no. That's not the intent of the administration, certainly not the intent of the Department of Law and the way we would handle cases.
Another question. The problems we're seeing with the drug trade and the fatalities and the crime related to supporting habits, is any of it associated with a single oxycodone that's provided to someone for necessity in that kind of situation?
Through the chair to Senator Marchicki, no, I don't believe that any of it is.
Okay, and then back to the, could you please describe the difference between the legal versus the black market marijuana industry, where the person in the black market industry may have marijuana for sale in one pocket and fentanyl-laced heroin in the other, both for sale? And can you talk about how we cleared that up in this bill by separating the two?
So through the chair to Senator Marchicki, the black market for marijuana, if you are not authorized under state regulation to be involved in the retail or cultivation of marijuana, then it remains a crime for you to be selling marijuana in that capacity. And so that's why you find those sections on pages 18 and 19 of the bill that still talk about marijuana, because it says if it's outside of the industry regulation, that's where the crime exists. So that's what it's referring to there. And I'm sorry, the second part of the question was dealing with something other than marijuana?
No, it was where we amended the bill to clarify that legal marijuana is not a part of the increased sentences in this bill.
Thank you. And that's actually what's found on page 18, and it's actually repeated in the number of different sections at the beginning of them, where it specifically exempts those individuals that are in compliance with those statutes that I read a moment ago. I think they were in Title 3, if I'm not mistaken, as well as Title 17, both of them.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just so we're clear, what Section 29 does is it says if a person possesses any amount of a Schedule 1A controlled substance, they are committing a felony. You may not have the intent to prosecute them with a felony, but would you agree that a trooper or a police officer could arrest a person, charge them with a felony, put them in jail, book them, that person would then be required to post bail, possibly lose child custody, possibly lose their job, possibly lose their housing? You would agree that all that are certainly possibilities under this new law. Would you agree with that?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, the law does indeed make it illegal to provide that oxycodone to another person, but when you ask me is it possible, then my answer would be not in my experience have I ever seen that happen. So those are two different concepts. I don't mean to split hairs with you. I agree that the law says that's illegal conduct, but you're also asking me about the possibility of it happening, and I'm telling you that based on my 20 years of experience, I've never seen a law enforcement officer take that sort of action under those circumstances. So I don't find it possible that would it happen, though the law could authorize it happening. And I just want to make sure those two different concepts are clear for folks.
And Madam Chair, if I could, not to split hairs, but I guess I'm wondering why as a lawmaker would I authorize a trooper to arrest someone, take away their liberty, put them in jail, book them, potentially arrest them, have them charged with a felony. Why should we possibly authorize that? Why should we give government the heavy hand to do that to an individual, even though it may never be exercised? And what I'm advocating is let's, as policymakers, make the law what we want it to be, because we have a lot of other moving parts that are completely out of my control. I don't control what a trooper can do or a law enforcement officer can do. I don't control what a prosecutor can do. I don't control what a judge can do. But I can control what, in some way, what the bill says. And what this bill clearly says is possession of one oxycodone or any Schedule 1A drug, and then it goes through the list, is a felony. Now, whether you decide to prosecute that or not, it's still potentially a felony under here. And that's what concerns me as a legislator, as a policymaker, is I don't know that I want to give you that discretion, because that's exactly what it is giving a whole bunch of people that I have zero control over, that we have zero control over, to charge them with felonies and take away their liberty rights. That concerns me greatly.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I understand the concern that you express, but when you say why would you want to have that authority vested in someone, why would you make it illegal to do those things, my response would be that oxycodone is scheduled as a 1A controlled substance because of the addictive properties of it, because of the other dangers that it possesses, and you're supposed to have a prescription for it so that a doctor can ensure that that's what's appropriate for that individual. I can't sit here and tell you what are all the circumstances that somebody might have, but it's not unheard of to say you have somebody that just for the first time goes out and tries a drug because, oh, their friends thought it was cool or something else was going on, and that person ends up dying from that because they didn't recognize how that drug would interact with what they have else going on in their system, for any other drugs that they might be taking, for any other pre-existing conditions that they might have. Those are all medical questions that doctors throughout the country, both at the federal level and at the state level, have said, this substance is so concerning to us. We are scheduling it at a Schedule 1A, the most serious level, and that's why it's so tightly controlled. You want to take issue with all those doctors, you're welcome to do that. But what this law does is it says that should be treated seriously.
So thank you. I think the point has been made. I think it is time to quit beating a dead dog and kind of move on here. There are other people that have questions. Senator Bishop.
No, I just wanted to muddy water some more, but I heard the chair.
Yeah, the dog is howling below the table here. So, Mr. Skidmore, I do appreciate you coming here impromptu. Unless there's any other questions in particular about the specific aspects about the bill, I do have, we did sort of leave Mr. James Stinson. I don't know if there's any other questions for Mr. Stinson at all. Okay, this is not the end of seeing this bill. So what we're going to do is, it is our intent to hear public testimony tomorrow and possibly go through amendments if there's time. So if you haven't sent your amendments to my staff, please do so by the end of the day. I also very much hope that we have new fiscal notes sent to this committee by tomorrow. They stated that they're ready, so we'd like to see them. So we are going to set Senate Bill 32 aside at this time. And our next bill is Senate Bill 33, just moving up the number line. This is an act relating to the rights of a prisoner after arrest, relating to pretrial release, relating to sentencing, relating to the duties of a prosecuting attorney, relating to treatment program credit towards service of a sentence of imprisonment, relating to electronic monitoring, amending Rules 38.245, Section D, Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure, and providing for an effective date. This is our first hearing on this bill. Public testimony is scheduled for tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. First, we'll have Mr. John Skidmore. You get to come back to the hot seat. Director for Criminal Division, Department of Law, Skidmore will present the bill. And so when you're ready, please state yourself for the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of Senate Finance. My name is John Skidmore. I am the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I've been asked to discuss SB 33 with you all today. SB 33 is the bill that is focused primarily on pretrial issues such as bail, such as the Pretrial Enforcement Division, the use of video teleconferencing, and credit for electronic monitoring that is provided pretrial, credit for that electronic monitoring provided pretrial towards an ultimate sentence, that is the ability to decrease the sentence as well as treatment. So those are the basic concepts of what the bill is talking about. I'm going to go ahead and jump right into the sectional, if that's acceptable.
Yes, thank you.
I'm going to start with Section 1. Section 1 is intent language that we've worked on with the Alaska court system. That is about an increased use, that is encouraging the increased use of video teleconferencing. It is language that's directed both towards the court system, the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Public Safety. The idea is that individuals don't always need to be transported to court. Given the large geographic area of our state, we can certainly find efficiencies in many hearings if we can have those individuals appear by video teleconference.
Is it, Mr. Skidmore, can I have you just scoot a little bit to the middle because it makes it easier for some of the folks on this side to lean down and see you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Section 2 of the bill talks about the time in which an individual that is arrested needs to be brought before the court for arraignment. Under current law, it's at 24 hours. Previously, Alaska law had allowed up to 48 hours, which is actually more consistent with the national average. This particular section would return it to 48 hours. It's not that we anticipate that the vast majority, and when I say vast majority, I'm meaning the 90 to 95 percentile of cases, would not still appear in 24 hours. We believe it would. What this provision does, though, is it gives some flexibility for things like arraignments that occur on Christmas or Thanksgiving or New Year's or the 4th of July or on Sundays. It gives a break both for the court system and for prosecutors that have to appear at those times to say there are some days that we could say it doesn't need to happen within 24 hours. That's really all that this amendment is, or that this particular section would be doing. We do not anticipate that all arraignments would be changed to 48 instead of 24. And that expectation is based on our prior experience with it. Section number 3 is a conforming amendment that deals with the elimination of the pretrial risk assessment tool. Sections 4 through 7, then, all really deal with bail. And section 4 is found on page 2, and it goes from there. What these sections do, section 4 eliminates the requirement that a bail review be required when an individual cannot post a bail. It eliminates the requirement that the court change. I shouldn't say it eliminates the requirement for a bail hearing. They still have the right to a bail hearing, but it eliminates the language that requires the court to revise conditions so long as they find that they could release them. It also removes the burden from being clear and convincing and returns it to what it previously was, which is a preponderance that the court's evaluating the dangerousness of an individual or their flight risk. Section 5, found on page 3, talks about whether or not a subsequent bail hearing, there's new information that has to be presented to the court. And what Section 5 is doing is it says that a person's inability to pay is not new information when it's originally been considered. The fact that the circumstances haven't changed in finance doesn't amount to a change in circumstance, which is actually the way the law currently reads. Section 6 is a conforming amendment with the elimination of the pretrial enforcement division as a separate division in the Department of Corrections. Pretrials enforcement would still be conducted by the Department of Corrections. It would, however, be folded into probation and parole, and so the need for a whole separate unit or section is eliminated, and so therefore it's a conforming amendment with that change later. Section 7 is really the longest section that you all have here that addresses bail. And what Section 7 does is it is returning the law to what it said previously about how the courts are to evaluate bail. We had something that people have referred to as the risk assessment tool that was coupled with our laws and the presumptions about how release would work. This would decouple it from that and return us to where we were before. Almost completely, not entirely, there are a couple changes. One of those changes is the ability to consider one of the changes deals with the presumption that is created in the section. There was a presumption that the Alaska Court of Appeals had found to be improper, and that presumption has been altered so that it would now be constitutional under the case that came out by the Alaska Court of Appeals. Sections 8 and 9 deal with third-party custodians. And you'll find Section 8 on the bottom of page 7. What they do for third-party custodians is they indicate that a third-party custodian is one of the entities. I'm looking at my bill here to make sure I have this right. Yes, it talks about that the third-party custodian can be appointed, and the change is that that's in combination with other restrictions. What the change here is that previously third-party custodians were restricted if the pretrial enforcement division was available in a community. So, for instance, a pretrial enforcement officer was available in Anchorage. You could not have a third-party custodian in Anchorage under those circumstances. This changes it back so that you could have a third-party custodian in any community. And what Section 9 does is it puts some additional restrictions on who can serve as a third party. This was a change that was made in one of the lower committees. It indicates that a person needs to have been unconditionally discharged, which means off of probation or parole, for a period of 5 years if they had been on that probation or parole from a felony, in order for them to be eligible to be a third party custodian. Section 10 is really a expanding on a bill that was previously known as the Truth in Sentencing. And what Section 10 does is right now the law requires a court to create a written order that explains when someone would be eligible for discretionary parole or eligible for mandatory parole. And what this section does, Section 10, is that instead of just having it be in writing, it requires a judge to state it orally so that victims know when they're in the courtroom what does this sentence actually mean in terms of how long would this person be serving time in jail. Sections 11 and 12 deal with electronic monitoring, and this is eliminating credit against a sentence for electronic monitoring that is applied pretrial. That is, a inmate or a defendant comes in and requests electronic monitoring pretrial, and the judge makes a decision about whether or not that's appropriate on whether or not the person is a flight risk or whether or not they think the person is a danger to the community. That's different than the analysis that the Department of Corrections makes after sentencing to determine whether or not electronic monitoring is an appropriate place to serve a sentence. And so this is the sort of concept that occurred with the Justin Schneider case, where someone gets placed on electronic monitoring, and even if EM is not an appropriate place for them to serve their sentence, they can get up to a year's worth of credit, sometimes more, against their sentence, thereby reducing the sentence that the court would impose. Sections 13 through 15 address treatment pretrial. In the same way that you can have credit and reduce your sentence for electronic monitoring, there's another provision that allows that for treatment. The difference here is that the previous sections for electronic monitoring seek to remove that credit, whereas for treatment, it would still be allowed. It would just be reduced to 180 days. 180 days is chosen because that's the maximum length of the treatment programs that we're aware of currently in the state. I think I've heard testimony in prior committees that confirmed that nobody else had found a treatment program longer than that 180 days. Section 16 is a conforming amendment to section number 2. Section 17 through 22 are all designed to allow that supervision pretrial to be conducted by a probation or parole officer. It changes different statutes that make it clear that that authority exists for the Department of Corrections. Section 23, we're now on page 13. Section 23 eliminates a report about the use of the risk assessment tool that the Department of Corrections was required to be providing. If the risk assessment tool is no longer something that is utilized, then the need for a report on it doesn't seem to make any sense any longer. So it sort of conforms with that concept. Sections 24 and 25 are the sections that deal with video teleconferencing. 24 I would describe more as a conforming amendment. It just sort of is changing some of the words that are used, but there's no substantive change found. But section 25 does create some substantive changes. And what it says in those situations is that there are certain cases in which defendants are allowed or required to appear by video teleconference. This says that the court may order it in other circumstances as well, those other circumstances being other pretrial hearings that don't impact the Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses against you. Section 26 talks about the ability to continue a case. It is a change in court rules that currently says you would have to have both the attorney and the offender agree to any continuance, despite the fact that many continuances are not the sort of things that the defendant's looking at. It's a continuance that the attorney says is needed for preparation for the case, for strategic reasons. Those are decisions that under the law are soundly left to the discretion of the attorney. This does not affect an individual's speedy trial rights. That is separate from the ability to request a continuance. Section 27 takes us to the repealers. There are only a short number of repealers. The first one deals with the pretrial credit for electronic monitoring. The remainder that are found in Title 33 are all about the statutes that previously discussed the Pretrial Enforcement Division as a separate division. And we already talked about the fact that it was rolled into probation and parole, so that's why those sections are removed. The remainder of the sections are sort of what I consider the administrative ones. You have the applicability, you have transition intent language for the Department of Corrections for those individuals currently being monitored to continue to monitor them, the conditional effect for the rule changes, and then the effective date, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Skidmore. That was a good summary, quite a bit of information. Do we have questions in particular about the bill? Co-Chair Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just curious, on page 8, section 10, when we're dealing with the report that the judge has to list for somebody that is, you know, getting a sentence imposed on them for a felony or exceeding 90 days, I heard you say the current, currently there's supposed to be a written report plus an oral report, but this bill changes it just an oral report, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, no. That's I apologize if that's what you took away from my comments. What I said is that the law currently requires a written report. It's generally in the form of the judgment that's issued in the case. That still remains. What this would do is it adds a requirement that not only is it in the judgment, but it also be announced orally at the time of sentencing.
Okay, and then if I could, Madam Chairman, just remind me who gets the report?
That particular report is the actual judgment in the case. The actual judgment is distributed so that the court system will keep one on file. The prosecutor would have a copy of the judgment. The judgment would also go to defense counsel or the defendant, and that judgment would also go to the Department of Corrections to know what their obligation, what the court order was about how long somebody would be in their custody.
And if I could, just to follow up, the reason I'm asking the question is just the families that are involved, the victims, or the victims' families, do they automatically get copies of these reports, or do they have to request them, or how does that work to make sure that the families are fully informed? And not only that, the media, so when they print their stories, it's clear to the public what the imposition of sentences actually is.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, as far as the media goes, they can obtain a copy of the judgment, usually from the courts. It's not infrequent that they also ask us to provide them with a copy of our copy, and we try to oblige them when that occurs. As for victims and their families, the law doesn't require that the judgment go to them, but the Department of Law contacts all victims and sends a copy of the judgment to them in a letter.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I don't know if you have fiscal notes and if they are current.
Madam Chair, we do have a fiscal note. I apologize. I don't have that fiscal note on me right now. I can tell you that it is a zero fiscal note, but I couldn't give you the analysis that's within the fiscal note. And I apologize that I can't read off the identifiers for the fiscal note, but I know that it's a zero, Madam Chair.
Okay. I appreciate that. So we do have, just for the committee's information, Mr. Skidmore was here to present us the bill. Just to put on your radar, committee members, we have Jen Winkleman with the Director of Probation, Parole, and Pretrial afterwards. We also have Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Courts. We also have the Public Defender, Ms. Goldstein, who we've heard from already, and Office of Public Advocacy, Mr. Stinson, all available to present. We have Nancy Mead, of course, standing by here in the audience. But before I move forward, I just wanted to make sure that everyone feels comfortable with the bill thus far, and if we have any questions for Mr. Skidmore. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 2 have, in the last couple of years, to your knowledge, has there ever been a time when a person hasn't been able to be taken before a judge or magistrate within 24 hours?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, in the last several years, the law has required that it happen within 24 hours. I'm unaware of a case in which it is not.
Okay. On Section 7, you're eliminating the risk assessment tool. And I know there was somewhat controversial over the years. And I guess my thought process is I understand the rationale for saying, yeah, we don't want to mandate decisions based on the risk assessment tool, but why not have it available as a tool for judges? Why not continue to make that tool available?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the Section 7 does not include the use of the risk assessment tool. I can tell you that the concept you're describing is one that I have had a number of conversations with folks in the building about. If there was a desire by the legislature for the continued use of the tool as a factor, that's not something that the Department of Law would be opposed to. but to have it coupled to the statute such that it is driving the ultimate decision is where the issues have occurred. But if the concept was to maintain the tool and use it as one factor to be considered, that's certainly something that's within the sound discretion of the legislature to make that policy call.
And then
Senator Wilikowski.
On the ability to continue cases, I'm just curious what the experience is. Are you running, is the department running into situations where a defense counsel wants a continuance and the defendant is saying, no, don't do that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have a percentage of how frequently that occurs, but yes, I can tell you that that has occurred. The case that jumps to my mind immediately was a case that was actually tried down here in the southeast where there were several defendants in a murder case that were saying they wanted to go to trial immediately, and their counsel were saying we're not ready to go to trial. The case ultimately did go to trial, and then after those individuals were convicted, they filed for post-conviction relief saying we had ineffective assistance of counsel because our counsel weren't ready for trial when they were the ones that had forced the case to go forward to begin with. So that's the sort of scenario that we look at and say this really doesn't make a lot of sense in why the change is proposed.
And just follow up on that.
Then we have a few other folks with questions.
Just curious, if a defendant makes a dumb decision like that, then they suffer the consequences. Did a court say there was an effective assistance to counsel in that case?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't believe that the post-conviction relief was awarded, but I do know that there was additional time that had to then be put in by both the defense and the prosecution and the courts to address what would have otherwise amounted to a frivolous claim. This change in the law would have eliminated the need to engage in that other frivolous litigation.
Senator Wilson.
Mr. Skidmore, in Senate Bill 91, we had the risk assessment tool was put into place without going through the regulatory process. Senate Bill 91 said within a year they'll have that regulatory process done where the public would have comment. And now we're on, year two of the implementation. Has the regulatory process happened with the risk assessment tool?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's a great question, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to it because I'm not the person that would be responsible for seeing that those things happen. So I'm not aware that it has, but nor can I tell you that it hasn't.
Okay. Do you know who that question may best be deferred to? Sorry, follow-up
question.
Yes.
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, the Department of Corrections was responsible for the risk assessment tool, and I don't know if the folks here from the Department of Corrections can answer that question, but that's certainly the source that I would go to try and get that answer ultimately.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I just wanted to take a quick pause. We're about 2:45. We did have Senate Bill 34 after here, but I think we'll probably bump that till tomorrow. So we're just going to still focus here on Senate Bill 33. If there's no further questions for Mr. Skidmore, we can move to Ms. Jen Winkleman with the Director of Probation, Parole, and Pretrial. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I appreciate it. So when you're ready, you can state your name for the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jen Winkleman. I am the Director of Probation, Parole, and Pretrial for the Department of Corrections. And I am here to, I don't have a formal presentation. I'm here to answer any questions you might have with regard to probation, parole, or pretrial.
Senator Wilson.
Would you be able to answer that question that was previously formed to Mr. Skidmore about the risk assessment tool and whether the regulatory process happened with the pre-assessment tool today?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, our Deputy Commissioner Kelly Good is in the audience, and she may be able to better reflect on the regulation answer.
Okay. Senator Wilson, would you like to have that person come up?
Please, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. For the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think you're referring to the regulations for the pretrial risk assessment tool. Is that correct?
Correct.
So when this administration came in, we found that that process for the risk assessment tool had been started and then kind of fell off. So the timing has gone through, so we have to restart it, which we are doing. The commissioner is restarting that so that the regulation for the assessment tool can go forward.
Senator Wilson, follow up.
Just as a follow up then, you know, the idea was within a year, now we're 2 years, looking at 3 years, and we're using a tool that doesn't have any regulatory process behind it. So is there a reason that we are just saying no, stop, cease until we have a regulatory process done with this tool, since technically the law has not been followed that was set forth in statute?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. So the regulations really pretty much codify what's in law. It's very similar what I saw, what they were putting for, the prior administration was putting through. By chance, are you, I'm thinking also, you know, the tool was going to be validated, and perhaps is that what you're thinking of as well, besides the regulation portion? The tool is before UAA and is currently being validated, and that may be another thing that, you are interested in. Both? Okay. And so validation is currently ongoing, and I think we're expecting it to be finalized in the next couple of months. Is that correct, Jen?
Yes.
Senator Michiki.
Yeah, clearly in this bill as the others, the issues that are captured in these bills are very specific problems that we're having today in Alaska. And the pretrial assessment tool, risk assessment tool, has returned people to the street on a regular basis that in no other reality would they have been regarded as being low risk. And those have been some very high profile cases, and in some cases repeated with the same individuals. So would you say that it's working, or do you support eliminating the assessment tool as a requirement and returning back to leaving that in the control of the courts?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, Mr. Skidmore went over that very well. The administration does have serious concerns with the tool, and therefore the administration put forth removing it. Yes.
Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you. What percentage of people who are in the Alaska correction system are pretrial at this time, and how do you expect that to change with the passage of this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Willikowski, I don't have the counts in front of me. Right now, Jen, do you have the, we've got about 2,000 on average in a day on pretrial. About half of those are on electronic monitoring. We can get you the exact percentages. We'll gladly provide that to you in the committee.
Thank you. Just along that same line of thinking, considering your current caseload and your current capacity, are your staff at appropriate workloads now, and can they absorb more cases, and kind of what's your thought about that?
To the chair, yes, we can, and we have considered that. And also in Senate Bill 54, there was a cap placed on caseloads of probation officers of 75, and so we're paying close attention to that with regard to absorbing these caseloads as well.
So I received a note earlier today saying that your fiscal note is not ready. When do you believe that your fiscal note may be ready?
To the chair, this is Kelly Good again. The fiscal note for this one is, I believe you have it. I believe the one that we're going to get up and ready for you is the Senate Bill 32, which we will have for you this evening. Senate Bill 33, though, I hope is in your packet.
Are you prepared to go over it?
I am, Madam Chair. Sylvan Robb is our Administrative Services Director. She is the one that prepares the fiscal notes, and she is not here today, but I can certainly have her here at the committee's request.
Okay, we'll have to schedule that at some point. So that will be, we'll worry about that in a bit. Are there any further questions here for the Department of Corrections? Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. Next, I would like to invite Nancy Mead, General Counsel for Courts, to review the impact this bill has on courts. And if you're prepared today, Nancy, to do your fiscal note.
available and updated. Thank you to the chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. The CS for SB 33 will clearly impact many of our practices in terms of bail mostly. The Section 7 provision takes the bail decision making and condition setting back to where it was before SB 91. As you're aware, since SB 91, the judges have been using the pretrial assessment tool to figure out what decision making they must use in order to figure out whether a person should be released on their own recognizance or alternatively have money bail allowed, which of course does have the effect of keeping folks in jail. So the changes in this bill will cause us to put out more training materials and use whole different decision making when it comes to bail decisions. But that's something that we can do. We did when SB 91 was enacted. I prepared those materials and the judges used them. So that is an impact. We don't have a policy call on that. That's for you to tell us how to make those bail decisions. I would like to point out that the legislative intent in Section 1 with respect to video conferencing, along with the two changes to the court rules regarding video conferencing, do cause us a fiscal impact, and that is the impact reflected in our fiscal note that I'll get to in just 1 second. Again, the legislature has the right to change those court rules, but I did want to talk about what that would do. And then I also want to say one section does impact us that you spoke of, and that is Section 10, and that's the section that would have the judge orally state on the record at the time of sentence when the person might be eligible for discretionary parole and mandatory parole. That is quite problematic for the judges. They don't have that information at sentencing. I believe that the Department of Corrections employs 10, 15 people whose job it is to do time accounting and figure out when sentenced inmates are eligible for good time credit, what other sentences they may be serving, what happened pretrial. And the fear on my part is that the judges will announce something that's entirely wrong or completely misleading. And that, again, would be very hard because they just don't have that at their fingertips during a sentencing proceeding. So I point that out. That would not have a fiscal impact, but it would have an operational impact for those reasons. I'd be happy to talk about other provisions of the bill, or I would go to the fiscal note as the chair.
Let's go to the fiscal note, if you don't mind.
Okay.
And I believe if it's fiscal note number 7.
I don't have the number, but it's the one for trial courts, Alaska court system. Yes, the only impact fiscally to the court system is from that video conferenced section, and if it's the legislature's desire, as expressed in that legislative intent, that many more hearings take place by video conference, we would ask for the support to do that. To the extent there's any video conference already pretrial, and there is, it's because court staff has done 99% of the work to have that happen. And we've done that without asking for resources directed towards that particular duty. We already have a person who spends almost all their time on video conferencing, troubleshooting, for example, and the agencies don't have the expertise, to my knowledge, to do that. So, for example, when a video conference system went down in Anvil Mountain Correctional Center, it was court staff who traveled there, two people, spent the time, figured out what was wrong, ordered the equipment, installed it. And to continue in that vein, this fiscal note asks for two employees. One would be a trial court coordinator to handle the logistics and arrangements. Having video conference in place takes a lot of meetings with DOC mostly to make sure that the facilities in the jails, prisons, are appropriate to have these take place and to provide, obviously, the video conferencing
equipment. So we would like that video conference coordinator, and we would also like an IIS, Information Services Technician, to be able to better handle all the troubleshooting and problems that can arise with that. The fiscal note also mentions travel costs, $5,000, supplies, and contractual in small amounts. And our total fiscal note on that is $224,800.
Thank you very much for reviewing that. I see two questions. So one with Senator Wilson, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. The video court conferencing, this is mostly just used for, is it just for inmates that just have trouble traveling to the court system? Is this for folks that just have normally public defenders, or is it just for just, I'm trying to get a better understanding of the increase of video conferencing and first, and then I may have a follow-up.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, the current rule requires that if there is video conferencing in place between a facility, a jail, and the court, then those defendants will appear by video conference for certain hearings, like arraignments, for example, non-evidentiary bail reviews. So certain proceedings pre-trial, they will not be transported. DPS pays for transportation. They will not be transported to the court, and instead things will take place over the video. So with the judge in, for example, Fairbanks, every day the arraignments are to FCC by video. And so that is what happens currently.
Just as a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Wilson.
Where is their defense counsel? Is it in the courtroom or is it within the jail with the inmates?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, for arraignments, the person actually doesn't have counsel appointed yet,
right.
And so there is no defense counsel. For the other pretrial hearings, it is true that the vast majority have been appointed a public defender, and the public defender is typically not at the jail facility, but is usually in the courtroom. That might be way more than typically, but I don't think they ever go to the jail facility, although they may. And so the defense counsel is in the courtroom, and therein lies part of the rub with video conferencing, because the client and the attorney are not together, and one of the sort of issues to be dealt with in setting up video conferencing is ensuring that the defendant and the defense counsel can have a way to communicate. And so not only is it just making a Skype call, there needs to be side rooms, there needs to be privacy, and there needs to be that system of communication. So it is that is a hurdle to get over anytime we set up video conferencing in a facility.
Okay. Just one more question. That was my concern. Thank you for addressing that. And so those things have been addressed with sort of this additional funding that's being addressed, or is there more funding or more system capability to make sure that client counsel privilege is going to be upheld?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, having the counsel able to talk to the defendant has to happen before we can have video conferencing. So all the video conferencing we have so far happening has to have that happening too. Which is the limit as to why even more proceedings aren't held by video. The funding that's in this fiscal note reflects the fact that the legislature wants us to do more. The legislative intent is to have, to increase it. So again, the only way it's going to be increased is if our employees make it happen. And so it will be that statewide facilitator and the actual person on the ground to do the technology. And our person is the one that ends up going to the jails because, to my knowledge, DOC doesn't have the personnel with that skill set or assigned to that duty.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Mead, the corrections fiscal note says that the department currently has video conferencing equipment in all of its facilities, and I know that they spend a substantial amount of time running folks back and forth to Anchorage from different facilities. I guess I don't see a specific savings for them. I know maybe you don't want to answer that. I also don't see a number captured by DPS who talks about the efficiencies associated with the video conferencing. Do you know if there's an offsetting cost from what I would expect that the offset would be to the positive, so that there'd be a substantial savings when you combine all three, the cost of all three departments. Can you answer that? Or
through the chair to Senator Machicki, the court system, of course, doesn't save any money from doing the video mm-hmm. conferencing. I have heard DOC say, without putting words in their mouth, that it helps them not have to transport because they don't have to check people in and out of the facility, for example. The Department of Public Safety is the entity that is responsible for prisoner transport, and they would, if anyone, experience the cost savings. I don't know, for example, if they still have to run the van from Goose Creek twice a day, whether there's 12 people on it or 8 people on it, because a lot of things still have to be with the defendant present. I do know, though, that the Department of Public Safety in past years has stated that they saved money, particularly in Northwest Alaska, with video conferencing, which is used extensively in Kotzebue, not having to transport defendants from a community jail or Anvil Mountain by airplane. And that was a cost that was high for them for a while, and that has decreased.
Senator Machicki, I do see that there is a Department of Public Safety representative online, as well as Kelly Hovel in the audience. Would you like to have someone from DPS come up and answer that question?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Kelly. Thank you for coming up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Howell. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. And Senator Machicki, through the chair, DPS does have a fiscal note associated with Senate Bill 33. However, it is a zero fiscal note. And if you'd like, I can explain the rationale behind that.
Please do, yes.
So as Ms. Mead stated, the Department of Public Safety is statutorily required to transport prisoners in the state. We move approximately 85,000 prisoners year round, and that's with the assistance of not only the Alaska State Troopers and our court service officers, but also municipal police officers and village public safety officers. So should this bill pass, we do anticipate that that pretrial hearings conducted via video conferencing would increase, and there could be some cost savings as a result of that. However, we transport prisoners for a myriad of reasons beyond just the pretrial hearings, and much of that is outside of the department's control, and a judge certainly always has the discretion to order the appearance of the defendant. So because of that, we estimated that there wouldn't necessarily be a savings as a result of that, or that's difficult for us to quantify.
So I just want to take a pause. It's a little bit after 3. Normally this committee would wrap up at this time. We still have, we're going to set aside, of course, 34 and take that up tomorrow. But to finish up 33, if it's the committee's pleasure, is we still have the public defender and the Office of Public Advocacy. We could go for another 15, 20 minutes if it's the committee's will to do so. Or we can push this until, okay, I'm seeing a couple nodding of the heads. Is it okay for folks in the room? Okay, Senator Wilson has a question.
Well, I want to follow up for.
Oh, okay, we'll have Senator Machicki, Senator Wilson, Senator Wilikowski.
So I just to wrap up that discussion, I mean, it's legislative intent, it's in section one, it's obviously important. Who is pushing the additional teleconferencing and why? If I don't see a obvious savings, is it corrections, DPS, law?
Is this for Nancy Mead?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure who can answer that best.
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, it is not the court system. This was part of the governor's bill. So.
And Senator Michigan, through the chair, this is Kelly Howell again. So this is part of the governor's proposal, and it does create efficiencies. It creates efficiencies for Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety. It's also an officer safety issue. The fewer prisoners we actually have to transport, the less risk there is to the officers transporting them and the prisoners themselves. So it does create a lot of efficiencies, and some of those are not necessarily monetary. So, again, the Department of Public Safety does transport prisoners. There could be a potential cost savings depending upon the number of video conferencing hearings that occur, but we have to transport prisoners regardless, and so, again, difficult to quantify any savings as a result of that.
We have Senator Wilson followed by Senator Wilkowski, yep. And then Senator Hoffman.
Mine was just more on a follow-up to Senator Michiki's line in which you said, Ms. Howell, was that there could be a reduction, but it's just you don't have a way to sort of quantify the number of inmates that would increase for the video conferencing, or that you would like to keep that number or an allocation down because you may have another area in prison transport that may increase with additional prisoners being in the system, so you just want to have a cost neutral. But this would create an efficiency, in the last paragraph of your of the note here. But including the better allocation of manpower and resources, it looks like you just want to sort of cost shift that to a different area of prison transport, but not necessarily for the video conferencing. Would that be correct?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I'm not sure it would be, it's difficult to say that an increase in video conferencing would be a savings for the Department of Public Safety, knowing that many of the prisoner transports that we do are outside of our control. We're not able to control that cost necessarily. So, yes, it could be that there will be additional transports required in other areas, but if there is an increase in video conferencing, there certainly will be some savings, but they may be, you know, shifted to other areas within the department, as you mentioned.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I have two questions from Ms. Mead. The first question is on Section 2, where it's doubling the time that a person can be held before being taken before judge or magistrate. And according to the Department of Corrections fiscal note, it says that this could is likely to result in a modest increase in the cost for incarceration, although they don't appear to quantify that. Has this been a problem for the court system, to have people taken before judges or magistrates within 24 hours after arrest?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, that has not been a problem for the court system. Over the last couple of years, that number has gone from 48 to 24, 24 to 48, and then to 24, and now I guess it would go back to 48. And in all cases, we schedule arraignments every day. Everybody is arraigned within 24 hours unless there's a particular specific reason not to. The law says 24 hours. There's a provision that allows the prosecutor to ask for additional time under certain circumstances, which very generally are that they need more time to gather information, perhaps about things that happen out of state, in order to effectively present facts about a bail release. So there are, when it was 48 hours, the reason people might go to 48 rather than 24 was generally because the defendant was not in a position to have a hearing. In other words, he or she was too intoxicated to appear. So whether it's 48 or 24 has very little impact on the court system. We still have them every single day, and people get arraigned within 24.
Thank you. One more question, Madam Chair.
One more question, Senator.
It's on Section 10, and you've expressed concern over that, and I'm wondering if you have maybe some different language that you might propose, or whether you would just advocate for that section being removed.
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, my preference would be for that section not to be there, since it's something that we will not be able to comply with. There could be something. We do give a victim information sheet to all victims who appear at trial, and we have it on our website. And when victims are telephonic, the judges talk about it to the victim. And that information I guess I'm thinking through exactly how it would go. That information to the victim lets them know how to how to get on Vine, the victim identification network, and other things, and how to that the victim has to be told, for example, what their sentence could be. So you could add something to the statute about the victim notification from the court that says that they need to be told something about the fact that discretionary parole might be something that comes into play.
Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is in regards to the transports. I've witnessed transporting prisoners from Anchorage to Bethel and Bethel to Anchorage. Some instances I see two troopers escorting one prisoner. Sometimes I see one trooper transporting two prisoners. So I don't know if the two troopers are transporting somebody with the caliber of a Hannibal Lecter or not, but what are the parameters of transport of prisoners by public safety? And has the department considered less expensive and maybe more trained personnel to transport prisoners back and forth between the regional hubs?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. Because those are questions that are really more of an operational nature, I would like to defer to the Deputy Director of the Alaska State Troopers who we have online. That's Major Andy Greenstreet.
Yes, we have Mr. Major Andy Greenstreet, Alaska State Troopers. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Did you hear the question?
I believe I understand the question. For the record, this is Andrew J. Greenstreet, Deputy Director of the Alaska State Troopers. And if I understand the question correctly, it was how do we determine what level of response for transports with any given prisoner? And there's a lot of different factors with that. A lot of it goes into the criminal history of the individual, whether they've made threats to escape or to do harm. And so it really falls into kind of a risk analysis whenever we do prisoner transports.
I might follow up, Madam Chair. The other part of the question that I had was, has the Department of Public Safety considered any alternative, less costly ways of transporting prisoners instead of using troopers? And the to address your answer, I think that many people understand that out in the YK Delta, over 90% of the crimes that are committed out there are alcohol-related, and it would seem that these are a lot lower in attempting escapes or other issues, because you're on the plane, and once you get on and once you get off, you're captive. So those two questions I would appreciate a response to. Thank you.
Yes, sir, through the chair. So when it comes to the cost of prisoner transports, whenever possible, we do have those transports conducted by our court service officers, which is their primary responsibility with court security as well as prisoner transports. So that's certainly our first preference. In many places around the state, we don't have them available, and so we defer to the troopers in the area for those types of transports. Also, you know, as Ms. Howell mentioned earlier, we do pay for the VPSOs and other municipal officers to conduct those transports for us. But more to your point, have we looked at a specific job class for just prisoner transports? Not in my time being here within the last 3 years, to my knowledge. And I'm sorry, sir, if you could repeat the second part of your question.
The second part of my question was the response that you gave was depending upon the potential for escape or not escape from custody. I would say over 90% of the crimes, particularly around the Bethel area, are alcohol related. And once they are received sobriety, the chances of a violent individual are drastically reduced. So I'm wondering if that has been taken into consideration when you're doing your assessment on what level of security you're going to utilize in the transport.
Yes, sir, through the chair. So I know when I did my, worked out in Kotzebue, many transports from Kotzebue region to the Nome Correctional Facility, oftentimes one trooper would do, six or seven transports in a caravan, and that was, to make the most efficiency, not only for the charter, but just as many passengers as possible. But there's inherent risk that goes with that. One trooper to that many prisoners, some would even suggest one trooper to two prisoners is a risk, especially whenever you are in an aircraft. And I know personally I've had prisoners try and open the door to the aircraft, and just last week I was reviewing a similar situation where there was actually two troopers in a small aircraft, and the prisoner was able to unbuckle themselves and was creating a disturbance within the flight operations of that airplane. So while I can appreciate that for the most part we do many prisoner transports on a daily basis and don't have problems, we have to be concerned and ready to respond for those situations that do present themselves. And that's simply, a lesser prisoner transport ratio to trooper.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. We're waiting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, on Section 10, would it be a problem that the when the judge finally gets all the information, does it have to be stated that day when the trial's over that the sentence and the terms are read across, or could it be post in the trial when the judge could have all his information?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, this contemplates the judge making an announcement at sentencing. Okay. Sentencing is the last thing in the case as far as the court is concerned. So typically the judge will say, I sentence you to 9 years, or actually more typically, I accept the plea bargain and you're therefore sentenced to 9 years or whatever it is. There could be good time. And this would seemingly require the judge to do a date calculation and to go to the discretionary parole statute and apply that statute to his or her sentence. The problem is it would nearly always be wrong. So many things can happen after that. It might get appealed. We don't know exactly when the person is going to start jail. We don't know how much credit they've had. They have other cases going on. And further, the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals has said that a judge may not consider a parole date in setting a sentence. In other words, the Court of Appeals has said you set the sentence according to what the legislature's ranges are and what's appropriate under the sentencing criteria, and you're not allowed to say, well, geez, you could get out sooner, so I want to do something different with the sentence. That's an inappropriate sentencing criteria, because the legislature has established discretionary parole and mandatory parole in Title 33, something that happens completely after all the sentences. And therefore, this would kind of run the risk of having the judge consider something they're not allowed to consider. So they don't talk about discretionary parole during sentencing to this point, but this would change that.
Senator, I think I found the answer to my question.
Senator Machicki.
I'd like to hear from the administration on their objective with this section. It's the first that I'm hearing that, and I may have missed it, that there's a conflict here, but I'd like to understand what they're looking for here and how we could perhaps iron out the wrinkles.
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, this section was not a provision of the government's bill, and this was added to my knowledge in the Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, would you like to have Mr. Skidmore speak about that?
Please.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. John Skidmore again, the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Ms. Mead's correct. This was not a provision that was originally part of the bills that were introduced by the governor. This was a provision that was added in the Judiciary Committee. The concept, I think, that was discussed at that time was that there are requirements both in rules and statutes for the court to try and provide an estimate of when somebody would be released so that victims can understand what goes on. I also agree with Ms. Mead that those estimates are difficult for courts to make, but it was an idea to try and provide victims, as the law currently exists, trying to provide victims some sense of what might a sentence actually mean. I believe this was an attempt in the Judiciary Committee to have that announced orally so that victims were more aware of it. But again, it was not a provision that the administration had placed in the bill.
Senator Michicki, follow up.
I understand. I just didn't hear any resistance to this particular amendment. And I think it has value, but perhaps it needs to be more generalized so that it doesn't cause a problem with the courts.
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, when this was added, I did not testify on this provision to state that issue that that I identified. And I will also say, and I don't think Mr. Skidmore will disagree with me, that the victims' rights statutes and other provisions in the law with respect to victim notifications do fall on the Department of Law, and to the extent a victim is present at a sentencing, to my knowledge, the Department of Law explains the sentence to them thoroughly, I'm sure.
Okay. Thank you both for being here. We do have, if the committee wishes, we can bring public defender Ms. Goldstein and or Mr. Stinson, Office of Public Advocacy. Are there questions from the committee for those two folks with the public defender's office? Seeing none, Ms. Beth Goldstein and Mr. James Stinson, thank you so much for being online for this whole time, and thank you for sitting through this bill, and I really appreciate your time here. We are going to be setting 33 aside at this time, and please let my office know if you have any concerns or amendments by the end of the day tomorrow. We're going to set 34 aside. Yes, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, it's a slide.
Okay. So that does conclude today's meeting. Our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will be presenting the CS for the capital budget, SB 19, and then after that we will continue on with crime of SB 34. Senator Michicki.
When is public testimony and which bills? Is that tomorrow afternoon's meeting?
1:30. We're going to try for sure 32 and 33, and depending on if we get through to 34, we'll do public testimony tomorrow afternoon also for those bills. Now, tomorrow is Friday. We do plan to meet as a committee on Saturday. I don't know exactly the time yet, but plan to work on crime bills and capital on Saturday. And on Sunday is a day of rest and a day of sleeping in. So that's the schedule for the next couple of days. All right. So this meeting is adjourned. Yeah.